right, everybody. Welcome to the Hunter's Quest podcast. This is your host, Hunter McWaters. And today I am joined by Dr. Jim Bechtel. Did I say that right?
You did say that right. Good morning.
Okay, good. Because I thought it was like Bechtel or something, but then I listened to Randy Newberg and he said Bechtel and you didn't correct him. So I figured it had to be right.
But I've had to correct him in the past.
Okay, cool, man. Well, like I said, I saw you for the first time. So, Alaska kind of changed my life and sort of got me into this whole thing. It was caribou hunt, actually, but a walk-in, like, DIY caribou hunt. It was my first, like, Western or, like, backpack trip. And that, like, changed my life and kind of set me on the course I'm on now. And then I went back the following year to Kodiak to hunt Sitka blacktails. That's this guy right here. And so when I was getting ready for that hunt, I was just, you know, as a lot of us do, like when you're about to go on a big adventure, you want to like watch videos of the terrain and the species and stuff like that. At least I do. And so I was looking for stuff, and there's not a ton of cool alpine blacktail hunts. I added mine to the list on there, which you can check out on my YouTube channel. But one of the ones I did find was you and Randy, and it was super cool. So I wanted to have you on.
Cool. Yeah, that was Randy and I had known each other for years, and I kept pestering him. I said, like, you got to come do this.
Yeah.
And I said, get a better appreciation for these deer. And Randy's got a huge history in Southeast Alaska that his uncles was up in Haines, and he used to come up to fish summers. So he had passion for Southeast Alaska, and we combined that for with our passion for hunting, and had a wonderful adventure back in 2015, and then redid it again for reindeer.
Yeah, super cool, man. And I'm the same way. I think I love all deer, but blacktail, there's something just special about them. I don't know. I killed my first Columbia this year too, which was a whole different thing, but really cool, special deer. I don't really exactly know why.
I think it's because they're so elusive. You know, unless you're in Northern California, you're not glassing them up that much. You know, you're like one-on-one, really close in the vegetation and stuff. And for ours up here, I love it because they call. You can call them and have these incredible interactions with, depending on the time of year and the type of call you use. That's always exciting when you're doing that.
Yeah, I've not experienced that hunt. Like I said, the only time I've hunted Sitka blacktails was in August. So it was kind of like somewhat similar to the hunt you did with Randy, but we got the luxury of being flown in, not walking up that horrendous mountain.
Yeah, but Tyler Johnerson is an animal. And Tyler told me about 5.5 hours in, he'd come over and he sat down and he goes, I owe you an apology. And I go, why? He goes, Randy told me it was going to take us 6 hours to go 1.25 miles and gain 1,200 feet. And he said, there was no piece of land like that in the world that was going to take me that long. And we're 5.5 hours into it. And he goes, I don't know when we're going to reach the meadow. He goes, this is incredible.
Yeah, that looked brutal, man. Recently I was at the Mule Deer Foundation Hunt Expo in Salt Lake City, which I go to every year. And I was standing there talking to Bo Martonic, actually, from the East Meets West podcast. And you walked by and I grabbed you. I was like, oh, hey, man, I didn't know you'd be there, but I just recognized your face. And I've always wanted to like sit down and have a conversation. So that's how we reconnected, man. So appreciate you coming on.
Oh, I'm excited. This is good to sit down and have these conversations.
For sure. Can't be bad if you're talking about deer, right? So you are the Alaska Regional Coordinator for Mule Deer Foundation, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So
what does that mean?
This goes back to, 2006 or 7. Steve Belinda, who's now the conservation officer for the Mule Deer Foundation, and I first met through another friend, Ken Barrett, who had an old show called Life in the Open. It was one of the very first hunting things where they were focusing on public lands. And I actually took Ken up to an alpine hunt, and I think it was the very first thick-tailed blacktail alpine hunt ever filmed.
Wow.
And but that was in like 2006, 2007, somewhere near. And so Steve and I become friends. And we had, through the Tongass National Forest and a couple other partners I had, we really were pushing the Mule Deer Foundation to have more of a presence in Southeast Alaska. And finally, in 2012, 2014, we signed some, the Mule Deer Foundation signed some agreements with the Tongass National Forest, but they never kind of gelled. They never went to fruition. And then they changed CEOs 3 years ago, and Joel came on board, and Joel goes, you know, blacktail are in our purview for what we manage for and what we our conservation of blacktail and or mule deer and blacktail. And it doesn't look like we're doing much for blacktail.
I feel like a lot of people don't even know that, probably.
Yeah, and so blacktail are a subspecies of mule deer. And there's a lot of
Interesting.
studies that have proved that genetically and stuff. So what came out of that was the fact that the Mule Deer Foundation was going to put a big emphasis into blacktail, both in or California, Oregon, and Washington, and up in Alaska. And I had just retired from the Forest Service after 39 years as a geologist for the Forest Service. And Steve Belinda called me and says, it's time to step up.
Nice, man.
And that's
So,
why I'm in this position. We've also now hired Scotland R. A young man that's a biologist who's right now living in Juneau, and eventually he'll be the front runner up here, and I'll take step back and take a lesser role in the Mule
okay.
Deer Foundation.
So that's really cool. I'm assuming that Sitka blacktail are native to Southeast Alaska. I know they're not Kodiak, but to Southeast Alaska they are, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. We've got bones in the caves that date back to about 10,000 years ago.
Wow, okay.
So that's about the time, that's the earliest record we have a Sitka blacktail getting out to the islands.
Okay. So what could you give me an example of like the types of work that you guys are doing out there for Mule Deer Foundation?
We want to focus on habitat. There's been a lot of past timber management, and that was first entry where old growth was cut. And now the trees have grown. The second growth that came back has grown back to a point that there's no vegetation underneath it. It's totally what we call stem exclusion. So there, the no light reaches the forest floor. So there's mosses and lichens and mushrooms down underneath there. It's great thermal cover for deer, but if they get in there, they can't survive. So it's our hope to go in and open those stands up. We're going to produce a couple saw logs out of each tree and biomass out of the limbs. And by opening that up, you get light to the forest floor. And that then that flush of vegetation will put deer back in that landscape.
So here's a question for you. Before modern white man was there, how did nature solve this problem? Or were the natives doing burns or something?
One of the biggest things that happened in Southeast Alaska is we don't have fire in our ecology up here. We have wind disturbance, extreme wind events that will lay down hundreds and hundreds and thousands of acres of timber in one swath. And so those natural openings then would regenerate with forage. And the old growth forest was open up enough that there was abundant forage underneath that. So there was. It was, you know, the best openings were in the disturbed areas and in the alpine slopes, but it was a continuous revolving door of forest falling down and regenerating, and the old growth forest getting to a point that there's so much light reaching the forest floor that it was ample forage.
Okay. Are there like less of those giant wind events these days?
No, we still have big wind throw events. We have a couple I can think of why I've been up here that's laid down thousands of acres of stuff where we, you know, peak out at over 140 knot winds. So, I
Yeah.
mean, they're huge events. When it has to be combined with a big rain event to soften the soil and depending on the maturity of the trees. So.
That's cool. Well, yeah, that's interesting. So, what was I gonna say? I can't remember. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. How are they doing population-wise, you know?
So, You have to kind of look at the dynamics of the islands of Southeast Alaska. So the northern part of Southeast Alaska, Abramtuchitchagof and Baranof, where deer are indigenous, they've always been there since they first reached out there post-glacial. They only have brown bears. So there's no wolves and there's no black bears on what we call the ABC Islands. Their population is mostly controlled by the severity of winter. And we haven't had a bad winter, knock on wood, since 2011.
Okay.
So their populations are doing really well. They're rebounding quite well. They're starting to get an age class back in. They lost up to 85% of the deer in areas in 2011.
Wow.
All the southern and central islands of Southeast Alaska have no brown bears, and they only have black bears and wolves. Black bears take 50% of the deer's population as fawns in the first 2 years of their life. That's
Wow.
well documented in three different studies that I've been involved with other researchers in ADF&G. Wolves definitely have a huge impact on the deer on that landscape. The nice thing about it is we never took wolves completely out of the picture, and we didn't have to put them back
Yeah.
as going on down in the contiguous 48.
Yeah.
And bad winters really take them. And then the influence of timber management. So in the central part of the archipelago, kind of Kuyu, Kuprinof, Mitkoff Island, and over around down by Ketchikan, the deer are rebounding pretty well and they're doing pretty good. And timber harvest wasn't quite as extreme. It was out on Prince of Wales Island, and the timing of that timber harvest was a little bit different. On Prince of Wales Island, based on my experience from moving out here in 1990, our deer population is down by about 50%, or maybe even slightly more,
Wow.
because this older second growth has closed in and is no longer habitat, and that compresses the deer into smaller areas. And the predators know that too. So the predators are there, and the deer are there, and we're there hunting them, and so that it just they're compressed into smaller and smaller bits of habitat.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking earlier what I lost my train of thought on was it's kind of like in the Pacific Northwest how they hunt clear cuts a lot, and that's where I shot my buck. It's because, like you're saying, once the old growth is down, all the browse can kind of come back naturally, and that's, I guess, pretty much their favorite food. Plus, you can see them.
Yeah, so in the 70s and 80s, we didn't have an abundance of killing winters. And there was a lot of active timber management going on with a lot of browse, and there was a lot of old growth left. There was a lot of intact forest. So even though a lot of forests had been cut down in large-scale logging operations, there was still a lot of old growth left. Well, then from the 1990s and now, there's been a further reduction in the amount of old growth, and all of that older second growth no longer is a place they can survive. And in fact, it's grown up.
Yeah.
So we're in one of those situations where we're losing habitat, and the bears are rebounding from an all-time low, and the wolf population fluctuates with the management constraints that have been put on them. So
Okay. We're kind of getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. That's really interesting, but I also want to hear real quick before we kind of get too deep into that stuff, is a little bit just about your personal history, like how you ended up, where you ended up, and what you're doing exactly.
I grew up around Mount St. Helens country in
Oh, did
southwest
you?
Washington, and hunting Columbia blacktail down there as
Okay.
a young person. And I always wanted to get to Alaska because my grandfather had been up here in the 20s and the 40s, and I grew up listening to stories of Alaska as a young man
Like
that
he went up there to hunt and came back or lived
he was
there.
trapping and hunting in the 20s, and then he was trapping and hunting and working up here from like 1937 to 1945, something like that.
Wow. Okay.
And he took a little Brownie camera, and so as a child, I had pictures of
Oh,
him,
that's awesome.
moose and caribou and stuff from the 1930s, and huge fish that he took out of the mouth of Lake Iliamna, just amazing stuff, and listen to those stories. And I had an opportunity to become the geologist for the Tongass National Forest, and I moved up here and fell in love with this place and realized that what was known about the geology was really sparse. There hadn't been huge economic developments with oil and enormous mines set up by Juneau. And so there wasn't a lot of intense geologic mapping that had gone on, and the mapping that was there needed a lot of work. And so that's kind of why I stayed and devoted my time to that. And it gave me, virtually everything from Yakutat to Ketchikan is where I worked. And that's an
Wow.
enormous piece of landscape.
Yeah. Now, are the is the islands, are they volcanic islands mainly?
No.
No.
Mainly they are. There's 11 little blocks of rock that have floated in from other continents and collided. There are some volcanics outside of Sitka and a few other places, but the majority of it is older sedimentary and volcanic rocks that have been rafted in and added onto the continent. So it's a really diverse geology as you move east to west, and there's more similarity as you move north to south along the
Okay.
panhandle.
And you said, was that your dad that was, or your granddad that was going up to Alaska?
My grandfather.
Your grandfather, okay. So when was the first time you actually went, and what was that like?
1991.
Okay.
I'll tell you, this is like one of those little moments. So Alaska is a big state, and I went up to Regal Air in at Lake Hood out of Anchorage up there, and we talked about options for a 2 week moose and caribou hunt, and he made a bunch of options, and I picked the spot. And we flew in there, and we both killed, Jim Brainerd and I both killed caribou. We both killed moose. And when I came back, my grandmother had found a box. My grandfather had passed away, had found a box of his old photographs. And his 1937 camp was 10 miles from where I picked
No
the spot
way.
to hunt the very first time in Alaska.
That's amazing, man.
Some of
That's like
the
a God
mountain
moment, you
backdrops,
know?
some of the mountain backdrops he had in his photographs were the same mountain backdrops that I had in mine. And that
Wow.
was, in fact, that makes the hair stand up on my arm right now.
Yeah, that's like a God moment, man. That's so cool. Probably you could have walked in some of the same literal footsteps.
Well, we know that he was over on Ptarmigan Creek, and I know we walked Ptarmigan Creek. It was in the Bonanza Hills, kind of over in the, up that Lyme Village area, Swift River Lyme Village, and that kind of stuff up in there. So,
Man, that must have been a pack job. Two moose and two caribou bulls.
yeah, and I was dumb in those days. I didn't realize you could call the moose back to camp, and you didn't have to. So, like the first bull I killed was 3.5 miles from camp.
Ooh,
Yeah.
that sounds rough, man.
I have later learned that you can pick your spot and call them in, and it's a lot easier on the back.
Yeah, that's wild. So, was it after that trip you were just like, I gotta get up there, I need to move up there?
Oh no, actually I had moved up. So in 1990 I
Okay.
moved up, and then so 1991, once I became a resident, that was our first trip. And then
Okay, gotcha.
we did trips into the interior almost every year for the next 20, 25 years.
That's awesome, man. Hey guys, I want to talk to you really quick about one of my favorite partners, which is blackovis.com. And I've been using Black Ovis since way before I had a TV show or a podcast or any of that stuff. They're kind of your one-stop shop for anything you need as far as solid hunting gear. They got camping stuff, they got crispy boots, seek outside shelters, Leupold optics, tons of other great brands. And they also have their own in-house brand, which is pretty good stuff. They got some really good merinos and some puffies that I've worn before. And they're at a great price point. The other thing I love about Black Ovis is their custom arrow shop. A lot of people don't know this, but you can send in your exact specifications for your specific type of arrow, your length, your fletchings, your inserts, field tips, all that stuff. And Black Ovis will custom make your arrows and send them straight to your door. It's a really cool deal, guys. So go over there to blackovis.com, check out everything they got over there. And when you do, use the promo code QUEST and you will save and you'll help support the show. So go to blackovis.com, use that code QUEST, and get some solid hunting gear. So when did you, I feel like you. Like you said, you were on what we think might have been the first ever filmed alpine blacktail hunt. So you were probably, in the early stage of people that were doing it at all. So, what kind of drew you to that and like got you started interested in climbing giant mountains looking for deer that time of year.
So anyway, when I first moved up here, there was a lot of deer, and you could find really good 4x4s or with eye guards at lower elevations. But there was a small cadre of people that went up to the Alpine all the time. And part of what I was doing was mapping caves and karst, limestone areas.
Oh, that's
And
cool.
a couple times I got helicoptered up to some of these incredible karst areas, and the amount of
Can you explain what a karst is really quick?
karst is a landscape of where groundwater or surface rainwater and groundwaters dissolve that landscape. So you have sinkholes and internal drainage and caves and up here vertical pits. A lot of it happened underneath the glaciers when the glaciers were here during the last ice age. And so it's a dissolved landscape with no surface streams and no surface water, but it's super productive vegetation wise, and it's preferred as forage by the deer in the Alpine. So
So
when
you were getting into
I
the good
landed in the
spots.
middle of this incredible salad bowl, and there was deer everywhere, and I was like, I got to figure out how to get up there. And
Okay.
what I saw were enormous deer. And that so that I started going up. And in those days, if you were living here and I was living here, we were talking, I would know what mountain you were going up, and you'd know what mountain I'd go up. And like, I would never go up your mountain without asking you, even though it's public land. I mean, that's just the way it was. And there was enough smaller cadre. Today, every mountain's got 15 people on top of it.
Oh, man.
And for the most part, I've stopped going to those spots, and I go to lesser known spots.
Yeah. That's so
So.
cool. So your work really took you into these what's the word again?
Karst.
Karst areas.
Yeah. So
So
the
I gotta
intense
ask.
limestone landscapes, these just beautiful sculptured by water landscapes with no surface water in them.
Okay, so I gotta ask, is there a way to identify those areas from like satellite mapping?
Yeah. Satellite mapping and geologic mapping. Go find out where the limestones and marble outcrops are.
Okay.
We did a lot of the ecological
Taking
studies,
notes.
and on right adjacent to each other, a limestone area, a non-limestone area had, if I remember right, it had 22 species of plants, and the limestone area had 74 species of plants, and you could stand straddle on that geologic
Wow.
contact. And the growth pattern on the limestone areas were 4 or 5 times the size for the same plant as it was on the non. So it was the nutrients from the soil being basic instead of acidic on the limestone that gave the incredible growth to these plants. And if you're a deer, where are you going to go? You're going to go to the good salad bar. You're not going to go to the
Course.
not so good salad bar.
That's really cool, man. 'Cause I'd kind of wondered if there was like a tie between, geology and biology. Like, was there a way that your training as a geologist, helped you recognize better hunting areas? And it sounds like for sure it did.
And it wasn't that I set out to do that. It was just my work in there and what I saw in those areas. And then I started researching nutrients and that kind of stuff and how that cycles and carbonate soils. And pretty soon it was like, I can't believe that if they're focusing on eating the plants on the limestone, that they're probably not getting more calcium and phosphate and stuff like that into their body and their bone structure and their system. They have better muscles and better antlers and just everything all around.
Okay, here's a question for you. This is just coming to my mind right now. When I was in Kodiak, hunting blacktails, the area we killed our deer was we were on a high alpine lake, and there was like kind of like tundra type landscape around us, and then behind camp, it like dropped down maybe, I don't know, couple hundred feet, and it was almost like a flat plain up in the but still in the alpine, and there was a stream running through it, but anyway, and the vegetation like you're saying was like way thicker and just a lot more, and that's where we shot, and my buddy shot a 107 inch Sitka
Well,
blacktail in there. Yeah.
that's a huge stick of
Yeah,
blacktail.
mine was like normal. We shot like they were standing together. He shot his and I shot mine within like 30 seconds. It's pretty cool. But yeah, his was 107 inch. But I'm wondering if that could have been one of these type of areas you're talking about.
It also can come from glacial till. A lot of glacial tills, although the gravels that might have filled that flat from when the ice melted and streams were running out there, a lot of glacial tills are calcareous. So you could also have calcareous sandstones and stuff. It's the limestone is the extreme end member of that stuff, but you can have other sources of calcium. Basalt sometimes, like volcanic flows will be a high calcium basalt, so I can see where that would alter vegetation growth and stuff. I think it's also really tied to drainage and how the nutrients can be released from whatever bedrock type it is.
I remember seeing when we crossed the creek to get our deer, it was extremely clear water and the stones were like white under it.
Well, it very well could have been, or it could have been granite too. But I mean, you obviously there you didn't have tannins in the water, which a lot of Alaska waters are brown to black in color because of the organic tannins in it. And there you were obviously not having tannins in the water for them to be that clear.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So you were looking for caves. Did you ever find anything cool in the caves, like any deer bones or like paintings or anything cool?
Yes to all.
Tell me about it.
We have hundreds of caves here, and so we have, let's see, when Tim Heaton was the paleontologist, he was from Vermilion, South Dakota, but he specialized in caves, and his collection had 57,000 specimens in it when we took it to the University at Fairbanks. So that was pre-glacial and post-glacial fauna. So until 10,000 years ago on the islands here, we had barren ground caribou running around. And there was brown bear more widely spread. And so, I mean, we found the bones of mountain goats. So as the ice pushed out across the landscape, the goats moved out onto the landscape at the ice's edge and survived. And so there's all kinds of biota. The caves have been used for habitation and ceremonial use by natives for thousands and thousands of years, and some incredible discoveries have come out of the caves in light of that. The cave-adapted organisms show a really cool genetic story about glaciation, and so this area has been glaciated, hundreds of times in the last 2 million years, and all of that groundwater moving through that limestone has carved these incredible systems.
Interesting. So what's the coolest, I guess, human origin thing you ever found in a cave?
Oh, I found in a sea cave on the outer coast, I found working with the archaeologist, I found a club used to kill fish. And from hitting the fish by the head and on the back, like rockfish, it had spines embedded in it. And
Whoa.
those spines dated to about 5,000 years ago.
Wow, that's really cool, man.
And then in another cave, I think one of the coolest things I was involved with, there was a cave that was what I would call one Bechdel unit diameter. So if I'm on my knees crawling down that thing, I'm occupying most of the space. And it split into two places. And down the right-hand side were speleothem. They were still had decorations hanging. And on the left side, they were all broke off. And we followed that, and there was a vertical pit in the floor. And down at the bottom of that pit, where it had walked in to hibernate and fell head first down, as the remains of like a 12,000-year-old brown bear
Whoa.
stuck in that pit. And beyond that, all the little speleothems and everything. So there was a moment in time as he walked in, he broke off all the little soda straws as he's walking along, and he fell down that pit. And we brought him out of the cave for the first time, like at his skull, when I uncovered it out there in the daylight. That's the first time he'd seen the light of day in 12,000 years, kind of stuff.
Was it like the same as a modern brown bear? Or different.
Yeah, the cool thing was there was a lot of bears identified as brown bears from the caves when we first started, and now we've been able to extract ancient DNA from those. And they were black bears, absolutely huge black bears, bigger than the bears we have today. So there's several leg bone measurements and a molar measurement you can do today to separate the two if you just have a tooth or something. So we were measuring that molar and assuming they were brown bears when they were actually just huge, huge black bears.
Wow, that's wild. So, okay, back to hunting blacktail. Was it kind of just like, oh, hold on a second, I'm getting a notification on my GarageBand. Do you want to use audio device? Okay, can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, I got my GarageBand started doing something weird. Let me do this real quick. Okay, so okay, so back to blacktail. Like, did you already have a love for blacktail? Because there's so many species as an Alaska resident you can become obsessed with. For whatever reason, it seems like you kind of went blacktail. I'm sort of a deer guy myself as well. Is that just because you stumbled on an area that had giant blacktail everywhere, or did you kind of like deer already, or?
I grew up as a deer hunter. My dad was a deer hunter. I mean, that was my hunting tradition, and hunting Columbia blacktail in the dense forests of Southwest Washington. That's what I cut my teeth on. And I got up here and I started to try to figure out these things called Sitka blacktail. And I had some mentors that in the community and stuff like that. But trying to go and read something on it and try to find something written on them and what's a Sitka blacktail, there was nothing.
Yeah.
And that just fueled the fire to figure these things out. It was like, you know what? I'm going to live here for a while. I want to figure these deer out. Not that I get schooled every day. Would I go out yet today?
Always,
But,
man.
I mean, that's what really created this passion for these deer. They're so beautiful and they're so similar yet different to other deer species in North America.
Yeah, and so that I gotta ask. So, what makes a Sitka blacktail versus a Columbia versus a mule deer?
There's of a Columbia blacktail, they're shorter in stature than a Columbia blacktail, but they're heavier in weight. I've been involved in several weighing things, and it's nothing to find a buck that's will field dress 150 to 160. A big mature Sitka blacktail, I've measured them clear up into 80, 180, and I've heard them going as far as 200.
Wow.
So I mean, they're really muscular, though short, and the double white throat patch and their shape of their tail is not ropey. It's more kind of like a white tail shape, but shorter with a black rim. Just physiologically, they're a lot different makeup than the Columbia blacktail, mule deer, or whitetail. Their antlers bifurcate. We don't typically have what we call non-typical, like mule deer antlers.
Right.
They're extra tined, but every once in a while, we get these really interesting oddities.
So they do default to like bifurcating antlers.
Yeah, so it's a lot of belief that a 2 point will become a 3 point, will become a 4 point, and a typical Sitka blacktail, a typical clean 4x4 with eye guards, I think that's like 5% of the population. Most of our deer here are a 3x2 or a two
Yeah.
by two or a,
This one's a
or
three
a,
by two.
yeah, and so they're, and they will be Sitka blacktail forever. That's right. That's a super typical
Showing it
deer.
on
And
YouTube, guys.
that deer would have got older and older and older and more massive and maybe longer tines, but it might never have changed that antler configuration.
Yeah.
And so, in fact, there's a special deal in scoring them for Boone and Crockett where you can reverse the G2, G3, because commonly there's four on one side and three on the other, and they would it would they so there's a way that you can adjust that to get
Oh,
it.
okay.
And
That's interesting. Yeah, my buddy's the 107-inch one. He was a 4x4 with eye guards, and he had this one giant cheater on one side. Looks
yeah.
like an extra brow tine just like popping out.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. You should watch that. You should go to my YouTube and check that out sometime. It's pretty
Oh, I
cool.
will.
Okay, what were we talking about? Bifurcating antlers. You were talking about, oh, physiological differences. Are there genetic differences as well?
Yeah, so Emily Latch and Jim Heffelfinger, working with I think it was the Boone and Crockett, did a paper quite a few years ago that took a look at how the genetics of blacktail changed going up the coastline, and it looks like you had some kind of a proto mule deer that got separated during the ice ages, starting 2 million years ago, with the Cascades having a lot of glaciers, and it isolated those deer populations on both sides of the Cascade Range, and they became up the coast. We know that they reached Haida Gwaii or the Queen Charlotte Islands by 11,000 years ago and then became extinct out there. And those look like they might have been Columbia blacktail. And then something came up the coastline and survived in small little refugia or unglaciated areas along the coastline. And as soon as the glaciers pulled out, they fanned out into southeast Alaska. And there's a paper coming out really soon that the genetics of the first deer that came out here were Sitka blacktail, but they had a signature of mule deer, where there must have been some interbreeding along that coastline. Those are in the deer that are older than 7,000 years old. And then all of the deer in the caves that we tested the DNA that are younger than 6,000 years are Sitka blacktail, and they're genetically different and unique than Columbia blacktail and mule deer. It's still a subspecies of mule deer, but you can genetically tell the difference between them.
So it's a subspecies of mule deer. They're not like all. So, guys, if you're listening, there's Sitka blacktail, mule deer, coos deer, white-tailed deer, and Columbia blacktail is the five recognized subspecies, correct? But technically, you're saying that blacktail are subspecies of mule deer.
Yeah, so all the blacktail are subspecies of the mule deer, and then all the whitetails are in a separate bite over here. So,
So the whole deer slam thing isn't necessarily based on biology. That's more like a hunting thing.
actually, genetically, you can tell the difference between those. I can give you a link to that paper that you can link to this.
So my Columbia was my last deer for a deer slam, which is pretty cool. Just because I'm a deer guy and I love deer.
Yeah, I've been lucky that I actually completed the deer slam, and I also completed it with my Hawken. So,
That's awesome.
yeah.
Okay, that's a good topic because I was going to ask you about that. You're kind of known for hunting with the Hawken. Tell me about that.
Well, I was a kid and went and watched Jeremiah Johnson in
I
the
love that movie, man.
70s. It ought to be something you have to watch at least twice a year in your home.
I need to watch it again. I haven't seen it since I was a kid, but it's such a classic.
So anyhow, I got into the history of the Hawken rifle, and years ago I was muzzle loading and rifle and archery, and I thought, I'd like to just focus on one type of hunting, and I just chose muzzle loading, and to make myself better. And I don't say this to be egotistical, but the fact that you have a single shot, and it's going to take you over a minute, which in a minute after you've pulled the trigger on a game, is an enormous amount of time. And so it forces me to make myself be better and make that one shot.
I
And
love
so
that.
that's what I really do, is I stress making that one perfect shot. And I got to tell you, if you could downplay my brain and see what I've let walk, because I couldn't pull it off.
Yeah, and it's something so kind of like pure about it too, like just walking through the woods with, it's not simple 'cause it takes some more steps and some more work and stuff, but just nothing but an iron sight. I don't know, something about it is just like feels pure.
I get close. I can do a with a round patched round ball, I can do a 3.5, 4 inch group of it at 150, but I don't want to make that shot. I want to make that shot at under 50. And I just got back from New Zealand. I just took a red stag with my Hawken in New
Oh,
Zealand.
no way. Oh, man,
Yeah.
I didn't even ask you about that yet. Okay, I'm adding it to the list. Okay, so you're hawking. So just kind of relating a little bit. It's not the same level quite, but I did this year. I drew an amazing New Mexico elk muzzleloader tag, and New Mexico just went to no optic on their muzzleloader. So this whole year, past year, I've been going to the range literally every Friday, and I have a, Western Precision, I can't remember the Williams gun sight, I think, Western Precision peep sight, and had a lot of fun with it, man. It's different, it's a challenge, it's cool.
No, I really like the iron sights. I was a little bit worried as my vision started to change as I aged on being able to see the sights, and I thought I might have to go to a peep sight over a buckhorn, but I've somehow come to agreement with it all.
Okay. So you're doing
And
it, you're using a
that's good.
buckhorn.
Yeah, I shoot a buckhorn. So the rifle that I have is not a kit. It's not a production gun. It came from parts from a company called Track of the Wolf, and it actually came off of a rifle that I think might be in St. Louis, Missouri, in the Museum of the Mountain. And there, it was one of Jim Bridger's last known firearms, and so it's kind of taken off of that. And then they make the stock and stuff, but the stock is like 90% inlets. You got to do a lot of work. And a gun for a thin gunsmith friend of mine, Dave Pope, helped me put it together years ago, and then I finished it up, and it is a tack driver. At 70 yards, I can put a single ragged hole all day long.
Okay, so you built it basically.
Yeah.
Okay, and
It's also got an inch and an eighth steel barrel, and it weighs 13 pounds.
it's the same gun you've been, how long you been hunting with it?
Built it in 93.
Wow. I was 6 years old.
In fact, I shot it out. It started as a 54, and I shot it so much in this wet environment that I had to rebore it to a 58.
Oh, 'cause the barrel was done.
Yeah.
You think you'd be able to hunt for it like for the rest of
Well, I can always bore it out as a 62.
life? Oh, that'd be good for the red stag. That's awesome, man. So, and guys, you got to go check out Reindeer is one of the films. Then there's another just on Randy Newberg's show. You shoot some nice bucks in that too, which is cool. I'm just thinking about which way I want to go from here. Okay, gotta go. New Zealand. So tell me about New Zealand because I actually got invited by a guy named Joe Edlington, who's a big like YouTuber, really good hunter. JE Wilds is his channel. But anyway, I got invited next year to go, and I just last night, I think I sweet talked my wife into letting me do it.
You gotta go.
Oh yeah. Tell me about it.
I booked this hunt 3 years ago because I wanted to go during the roar.
Okay.
And the roar is the last couple of weeks of March through the like th 3 weeks of April. So
Okay.
that's their September. As we were down there, the leaves were changing color and it was getting cooler in the evenings. And the roar of the red stag is crazy. Absolutely crazy. And I was hunting on out of a lodge on private property, and it was a hunt. There was no doubt about it. And we spotted this stag, the one that I wanted to get the night before, and I passed on two stags. The shots didn't feel right. They were at like 90 yards and the wind was howling, and I said, you know, I don't want to do this. And the next morning we found him again and watched him till about 10 o'clock, and he bedded down and the wind was howling, absolutely like 40-mile-an-hour winds on top of the ridges. And we slipped down through three canyons and came up, and I got within 27 yards of him in his bed, and
Wow.
he was looking away. And the young man that was guiding me roared and challenged him, and he stood up, you know. And I was saying that was like 50 years of dreaming about that 1 minute, 1 second of your life. You know, it's just like an amazing thing. It was definitely a bucket list thing for me. It took a lot to get my firearm down there. You have to get a license from the government and to find black powder. And what I went through to get the black powder and the caps on the South
Oh,
Island.
yeah, because you can't fly with powder.
No, I found there's a gentleman called Van Teal Pyrotechnics. So if you've watched any of the millions of movies that's been filmed down in New Zealand, all the explosions and all that stuff, he does that for the movie sets. But in the side, he builds black powder. So I went to his house, and Martin and his lovely wife, Debbie, we had coffee and a few cookies, and then we went out and I tested his black powder. He had a gong outside of the barn, and I found a powder that worked, and he made it available on the South Island, and I went down and bought a kilogram of powder, but I couldn't find caps. And so I finally found some guy that was part of a black powder shooting group in the middle of the island, and he agreed to sell me a half a tin of caps. And they were
But
CCI
you
caps.
didn't even know going to New Zealand that you're going to be able to find caps?
Martin said that he would be able to get them to me.
Okay.
He had made them available on the South Island, but in the 2 weeks of our vacation before I got there, somebody had come and bought them all.
Oh, no.
And but she had the name of the guy who had bought them all, and I contacted him, and he realized my dilemma, and he said, "Well, I can make this happen." So my wife and I drove
That's
out
cool.
to nowhere and met him, and I bought it. So
You
my
jumped through some hoops to get your hawk in over there,
I
basically.
took one shot in New Zealand at that animal. I paid
That's awesome.
$207 New Zealand, which is about $130 for a kilogram of powder, and I paid $20 US for a half a tin of caps. So that single shot was $150. So I'm never going to complain about the price of reloading again.
Yeah, but it was all worth it, like you said, for that one
Was
moment.
all worth
That one moment. So what was that like when you got your hands on that guy?
Oh, it was just, they're so beautiful. Holy crap. They're just an amazing. I think the original animals had come from Scotland, and kind of the whole history of how they got to New Zealand. And they were almost annihilated in the 60s and 70s by aerial killing. And then a few farmers and ranchers decided, hey, we should preserve some of these, raise them for meat, and raise them for hunting. And so it was the insight of some of these early folks that allow us to hunt in those places. Not that there aren't wild lands that you can't hunt them on what the equivalent of private or public land. But a lot of these places that we hunt stags are were
Yeah.
created by the insight of a few people back in the 80s, just saving some of the deer and putting a high fence around them.
Yeah.
The place I hunted, it was definitely a high fence around the margin, but most of the time you didn't even know. I mean, it's just an enormous block of land.
Yeah, at a certain point it doesn't even matter, but yeah, so that's interesting. So 'cause that could be a controversial kind of question. So I hunted Audad this year too, which is similar, like, there's more Audad in Texas and New Mexico and now Mexico than there is on their actual home range, and way bigger ones, and it's a really cool hunt. To me, and some people say they push mule deer out of, out of that country. And so anyway, you're a hunter and a biologist, so you might be a little different than most straight up biologists, but how do you feel about that? About, like, quote unquote, like some people call them invasive, some call it introduced or whatever, exotics. How do you feel about that?
All you got to do, I mean, if you look at what's gone on in New Zealand and Hawaii and stuff like that, those are extremes on those islands with birds and the pests that were brought in, the mongoose and the rats and the
Right.
pigs and all of that kind of stuff. Those are extreme ends. As far as the oddeds and that kind of stuff, I don't know. I haven't read enough about the displacement of other animals and stuff. And I don't know if they occupy different habitats. I mean, like here in Southeast Alaska, they planted elk over in Etlin Island, close to where I live. And the big concern was that they would compete for winter range for the deer on Etlin Island. And the difference, they actually kind of occupy a little bit different landscape than the deer do. And I don't think there's been a great loss of deer numbers because of the introduction of elk where they weren't.
Yeah.
It might have kept predator a little bit higher stance for a while because all of a sudden there was a new animal that had no experience with wolves or something like that. But no, I don't know.
Yeah, that's all
I,
right.
I'm I'm not I'm not a huge advocate for. It seems like every time we play God as humans and things onto a landscape, somebody somewhere suffers
Yes.
as a result of it.
I was gonna say the exact same thing. It's like, it seems like no matter how good our intentions are, at the end of the day, normally when we like introduce something, no matter what it is, there's negative effects. And I have a I'm very similar to you because I have a very similar stance on it. Like you were saying, some of the rats and like the feral hogs and stuff that are like obviously very detrimental to the ha like is terrible. But like you think about like a tar that's like living up in like above the tree line where pretty much nothing else was probably living in New Zealand. I would assume.
Actually, there's a program right now to limit their numbers because of the fact that they were disturbing the habitat enough that the Kias, the flightless parrot that's up there, and a few of the other things were suffering from the habitat loss. So there was a tar reduction program. I don't know if it's still going on over there,
Interesting.
but
I
they're
hope I
trying to
can.
reach some balance between a smaller number of tar in certain areas and not so widespread.
Yeah, it seems like there's always a negative effect to some degree. But anyway, I have a complex relationship with the question because I love nature and stuff like that, but I also love hunting, so I think
Oh
it's cool to have Audad and tar and stuff. And I hope to be one of those tar controllers soon.
I'll give you a real quick little digress. In 1986, I was a geologist on a project at White Sands Missile Range, and I was working out of San Antonio, New Mexico, in the near the old Stalin site, close to where the Trinity site was, and drilling. And I had to move the drill rig and take it down through the middle of the back of the range down to the Tularosa Basin to a different part of White Sands Missile Range. So I had CDL in those days, and I took off with the truck and the drill rig and stuff. And it's 2 or 3 in the morning, and I'm drinking coffee and listening to country western on the radio. And I'm driving down as the sun's coming up in the desert, and I'm by myself. And I look ahead where it had rained that night before, and there was water in the middle of the road in the ditch. And I look down, and there's about 200 aurochs. And I didn't know they were planted out there. And my brain is going African antelope, and my other side of my brain is going, this can't be. And I slow the truck to a stop. And they just kind of parted. We're standing around the truck, and I was like, the sun's just coming up, and I'm like, what the heck? Where have I been beamed to?
That must have been weird, man.
Course, now I know it's a thing out there, but.
Yeah, I was driving through Texas this year, and I look over, I see some roadkill, and I look over, and it's an oryx, and I was like, it's same, like not on the same level, but similar, kind of like what? But I knew they were there. It just took my brain a second to figure it out.
Must
But
have got loose from somebody.
yeah, it was weird. Or I don't remember if it was Texas or New Mexico. I can't. But one of those places, I saw one on the side. It was just like basically like skin, dried, mummified skin at that point. But I could tell it was an oryx. Okay, so. You're obviously a very thoughtful guy, scientist, hunter. Where do you fall on intelligent design?
Meaning.
Meaning, so when I was born in a Christian household, and so I still believe that the world was created. But one of the main problems I had that I ran into with my faith was the 7 day literal 24-hour period creation, and also the world being approximately 4 to 6 thousand years old. What I saw as a outdoorsman, as a self-proclaimed naturalist, and like I've always been interested in geology. I'm not a geologist by any stretch, but always loved rocks and geology. And I see, but I also see the interconnectedness of things. But anyway, that model just didn't make sense with me. Then I found through a long process, I basically am an old earth creationist. So I still believe that God created the earth. But I think that it's possible that each day was even perhaps millions of years long or something. I don't think Genesis is a scientific novel. It's a Hebrew piece of poetic literature describing the creation. So anyway, I don't know. Where do you fall on that stuff?
I believe in the great antiquity of the earth. So when my parent, when I was a little kid, we didn't particularly go to church often, although I think we were Methodist. But my mother and father wanted me to have a better education, and there was a Catholic school next to where we were. I had to be bused over for about a half hour over to this little cat, and there was like my first, second, and third grades were in the same room. with Sister Rosaria. And somewhere during catechism class, I asked where Neanderthal man fit into all of that as a little third grader. And marched me off to Sister Superior, who took me over to the priest. And he said just about what you did. And I have used this in teaching geology. When I teach historical geology, I talk about millions and millions of years on there. But I always tell this story. He said, if you take a look at Genesis and how it's described, it basically follows geologic history. And as long as you don't get locked into the fact that it took 7 days and a day being 24 hours, if days can be millions or hundreds of millions of years, he goes, I have no problem with looking at geologic history in that context. Yep. And he told that to a third grader.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I have never forgotten that. You
that's
know,
cool.
And so when I teach those classes, I said, look, in this class, I'm going to teach it this way. And I realize that that might not quite agree with your beliefs, which I have a lot of value in, but you might consider this.
And so you would basically consider yourself an old earth creationist as well?
I don't have any problem with something creating that if millions of years can happen.
Oh, yeah. You know, yeah.
That spark of life or however we got to where we're at. But if it didn't happen in 7 days, if it happened in 4.5 billion years, I don't have a problem with it.
There's a guy when I was going through all this that I'm hoping to have on the podcast soon who is an astrologer. Or wait, no, I said that wrong. Astronomer. Very, very big difference. Astronomer named Dr. Hugh Ross. And he's like one of the leading old Earth creationists. Really brilliant guy. Hope to have him on. So you should check out his some of his stuff. He's got some amazing books about that, and like that's a whole other topic. But one of the things he says is the Hebrew word when they say day in the Old Testament is yom, and it just really means like time period or era. It doesn't even necessarily, it can translate as a 24-hour day, but that's a translation thing that they say day, but it's yom is not actually specifically a 24-hour day. But anyway, it's pretty interesting stuff.
I have spent much of my life as a paleontologist on excavations and digs and studying how different families of mammals and other things have evolved and changed through time. And I think it's a wonderful evolvement.
Yeah. So do you think that, I kind of had to ask you that question before I asked you this question, but so like, do you think that, so in my perspective, I would say it's possible God created a deer, and from that, because of different ecological or geological events or whatever, they kind of changed into these different types of deer, almost like dogs. Do you think that's kind of maybe how it went down?
Everything came from a proto something, you know, like whales once were a land mammal that went back to the sea. You know, and they still hold some of the evidence that they once walked on the limbs that are now flippers and those kind of things, and especially the toothed whales. But deer were like that as well. And there was, look at the, if you go back and look at any historical text about how antelope have changed through time from these bizarre forms with like horns coming out of their nose and all this kind of crap to what we have today. Is this incredible beast of the plains, you know?
Yeah.
And it all started from some wee beastie. I remember a few years ago working with a fossil palm frond that I found that was 53 million years old. And in the sediments around there were the four-toed tracks of the first horse that was about the size of a house cat.
Four-toed horse,
yeah.
The size of a cat?
Eohippus is what it was called, you know. And it was, so like after the dinosaurs all disappeared, the mammals and the non-avian or the avian dinosaurs, the birds and stuff like that, just exploded. And that was their time. That was the time of mammals and the time of birds. And there was so much change has happened over that amount of time.
Fascinating.
It was a cleaning of the slate. So there's been those cleanings of the slate through geologic time, like five or so great extinctions, where like 80% of everything disappears.
Yeah, that's so weird. Man, that's a
Resetting
whole
the clock.
Sorry, I keep getting these weird notifications on my GarageBand keeps like messing up on me. Anyway, yeah, that's so interesting. It's weird to think like of that, like where the proto, like it's almost like a chicken or egg thing. It's like where did the proto come from? Like when did it stop being the proto and become something else? Or anyway,
That's one thing that we there's only bits and pieces of deer as through geologic time in the last like 20 million years. There's only like these little small samples. We only get a glimpse of what was there before and what they've until we get up into like the last maybe 50,000 years or something like
yeah.
that. Then we actually start seeing the deer we know start. There was a great site in Colorado called Snowmass. Was that at Aspen or Vail or something like that? They were digging a hole to store water so they could make snow when there wasn't snow on the ski slopes. And they opened up this bog, and in there was one of the earliest bifurcated, looks like a mule deer. And so that was pre-glacial. So that was somewhere, I think, at 30,000 years or something like that.
Yeah, so obviously there's no problem with a chihuahua coming from a wolf, from my mind. Even more
I don't
extreme.
know if I buy that. I don't know what the ancestor to a Chihuahua was.
Well, you know what I mean. But they're basically canines. I don't know if I fully can buy into the whales from land mammals. That seems like completely different creatures to me. I don't know.
Well, the evidence that I can see and stuff like that, the first things were more bears and dogs kind of split up back in there somewhere. And there was a beast that fed along the shoreline. And finally, it fed further and further out and lost those adaptations. And I've seen the fossils in the rocks, and I've seen the fossils after they've been prepped. And it makes good sense that it
Yeah.
once was more, don't want to use the word bear, but it's more of a land carnivore that became a carnivore of the sea.
Yeah. Wow. That's so interesting, man. I just wanted to show you this. I think you'll find this interesting. I found this in New Mexico.
Oh yeah, it's gorgeous.
Isn't that cool? Actually, technically, my camera guy found it to me, but for some dumb reason, he gave it to me. But yeah, and that was, in the middle of a desert on top of a hill. So, but one day, I believe one day we'll know the answers to all these questions, but I guess right now it's just veiled a little bit. Oh, one more thing I gotta show you. This is a Columbia blacktail shed that was given to me by my friend in Oregon.
Oh, that is amazing.
Can you believe that?
I can. That is just a crazy down when you get down right about the California border and stuff down in there. I've seen some of those deer that's been taken down in there. And
Yeah.
yeah, holy
So
buck.
I taped mine at 140 inches.
Yeah.
He was a beast. It's the biggest deer I've ever killed, and it's a Columbia blacktail.
Yeah, I took one in 2004 in that 100M muzzleloader hunt down
Oh,
there.
cool. Yeah. I know what you're
At
talking
Currica
about.
Rut, I took one that was slightly over 140 inches. It's just a
Oh,
giant.
nice.
Yeah, I'll send you a
Yeah.
picture.
Yeah, you should. Off air, remind me, I'll grab your number. Because my friend did that same hunt with his granddad, and they did it with a, I think it was a gun they built. It was a, I think it was like a cap lock or flint lock or something like that. It may have been a Hawkins, I'm not sure. But anyway, man. Okay, last question. This one's kind of weird or random. You ever seen a Bigfoot?
If I would, I'd have a taxidermy downstairs.
Yeah, okay.
Oh my God. There are a number of years ago on Prince of Wales Island, that History Channel or Discovery Channel Bigfoot show came to Prince of Wales Island, and they couldn't get anybody to talk to them. And They tried to get me to talk to them because they knew the Bigfoot lived in the caves, and I must have had the secret to where all the beds were and all of that kind of stuff, which we do find bear beds that are lined with boughs and stuff in the caves. I mean, they do use them. And it got to the point that they were sending me scripts, and I could see they were going to take my words out of the script and morph it into saying, yes, they live in the caves. And so I passed it off to the young lady that was working with me. This became a joke between us. And eventually they disappeared. They couldn't get anybody on Prince of Wales Island to tell them anything, but they were brilliant. They came back and they bought like 4 kegs of beer and put a huge barbecue on. If you would come and tell a story about Blackfoot, you could have free beer and barbecue.
There you go.
I mean,
That's not biased at all.
no. And so that's the way they got the stories. And if you look at that thing when it came out on TV, they show you where there's trees stuck back in the ground upside down. Well, that's where the guy's logging with a shovel, and he's got a sense of humor, and he'd pick up a small hemlock and grab it and stick it in the ground.
Yeah.
And we all know where these things are on the island. We call it logger art. It's like, but they put that as the major reason where they were marking their territory on the
Oh man,
island.
that's a stretch. But do you believe in Bigfoot though?
I grew up in Winlock, Washington, with the guy that took the picture up at Mount St. Helens back in the, I think it was the 60s or 70s. And so
Yeah.
when I was a little boy, I was in the barbershop listening to his stories directly from the man. And no, I don't believe in Bigfoot.
Okay.
I believe
Fair
there are
enough.
things, I believe there are oral traditions from the natives based on natural occurrences that are out there. And I've heard things I can't describe and explain, but I know that there's a description of them if I fully understood why it was going on,
Okay,
that
tell me about one of those things you can't explain.
weird screams and crap in the night that I couldn't identify. And I know we don't have mountain lions here, and up here it's referred to as a kushtika or the trickster or something that's often like an otter man and of native oral tradition. And I don't know what these sounds were.
What did they sound like?
Some cross between a rabbit being caught by something and female mountain lion in heat screaming.
Whoa, okay.
I don't know. I don't know how to describe it.
Interesting.
And just things you run across, but I've never seen any tracks. I've never seen any hair. I've seen pretty much whatever out in the woods.
What's the weirdest thing you ever seen?
Ooh. I was up in the interior and I watched two wolves. Two juvenile wolves tried to hamstring a really large, I'm a medium-aged brown bear male. And then those two walked down the river for a long ways together. And the bear was obviously frustrated and just kind of putting up with it. And like a magpie went over and harassed the bear and then flew up in the tree, and the bear runs over and leaps up in the tree and try to grab the magpie. Meanwhile, the wolf is standing right next to him. And the bear finally turns around and says, I've had enough of this shit, and ran the wolf out of the country.
Oh, weird. That
In
is
fact,
weird.
I have a YouTube channel, and you can go watch that video on my
Oh, okay.
YouTube.
Nice. But
I
other than
happen to
the.
have it. I had a camera, and I just kind of, as it started to progress, I quickly pulled it out and captured that on film.
That's awesome. But other than the weird, unexplainable screams, no, they're kind of like weird, unexplainable stuff like that.
No.
Okay. I always ask people that spend a lot of times outside.
Most everything that I've ever heard or experienced that I've been able to rationalize and why it happened.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
And sometimes it's something of my own making. We go out into the forest, and if we're fortunate, we harvest animals and we bring them back close to camp, it goes against everything that we're taught not to do for keeping camp safe and stuff like that. So I think a lot of times we set up. I've heard brown bears make some noises that are just crazy
Yeah.
noises. I've heard moose do what's called the lion's roar when they get super agitated in it. And the first time I heard that, it just scared the living hell out of me. I knew there, and the alder were swaying back and forth, rushing towards me from like 150 yards up the slope. And I knew the world's god biggest brown bear was going to step out of there in this like 60-inch bull moose. I
Whoa.
was butchering a bull moose, and he stopped at 30 yards and challenged me standing on there. He was challenging that bull.
That's scary.
Yeah, got
That might
crazy.
be just as dangerous as the bear. Man, that's cool. Well, I could probably sit here and jaw with you for another couple hours, but I know we got both stuff to do. So, where can folks go if they want to kind of see some more of your stuff and or check out more about the Mule Deer Foundation?
So as we progressed in trying to understand this, I partnered with Sophie Gilbert. Who used to be a university professor in Idaho, and Todd Brinkman, who still is a wildlife biologist up at Fairbanks, to create sickofblacktail.org.
Oh,
And
cool.
we've got our own web page, and you can go there. We try to keep all of the scientific publications up there. I have a deal called a blog from the deck, and you can go there, and there's 30 or 40 things that I've written about experiences out hunting sickle blacktail in the woods. Tons of photographs, links to videos. I've got a deal about how to hunt Prince of Wales Island on there. There's all kinds of stuff.
Is it a pretty good opportunity, like DIY type opportunity for out-of-staters?
I gotta tell you, our population is so low now on the island that there's way better places to hunt sickle blacktail. Prince of Wales Island is not the panacea that it used to be. And there's still deer here. And I still think that we have better genetics. I've been super fortunate in the deer that I've taken 1998 in one of those karst areas. I took what's the world record with sickle blacktail for black powder?
No way. I didn't know that. That's amazing.
It grossed
How big was he? What did he measure?
125 inches and netted
Whew.
121.
Oh my goodness. That is an absolute monster.
Yeah. Actually, I'll tell you what, you want to talk about sizes? We talked about morphology. 3 days after I shot it, on certified scales in Thorne Bay, I had 91 pounds of close boned out meat.
Whoa.
That buck was really close to like 275 pounds,
Oh my
probably on the
gosh.
hoof.
Yeah. And I remember you were talking about that earlier about how they're heavier than Columbias. And I also noticed mine, obviously, I guess because of the winters, like he had like inches of fat on his rump. You know what I mean?
Oh,
I
yeah.
actually took some of that with me. I ground it into my burger. No one ever does that.
We do it all the time. So our
Okay,
deer
good.
feed on forbs in the alpine, and their fat is sweet until September when it freezes and they move down into the trees.
Okay.
And
So
so
my
I,
instinct was correct to get some of that fat.
yeah, so I our season starts July 24th, and I try to get one of those early bucks, and I take that big thick fat off the back strap and the rump, and I pre-grind it, and I add that to my burger for the rest of the year.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, I did that as well, and somebody told me I was dumb for taking deer fat. But I'm sorry, I'm distracted. I'm sending you a picture right now of my Columbia blacktail just because I want you to see them. Is this your cell phone on your card?
Yeah.
I'm not gonna say it on air. Don't worry. You still get out after him?
Oh
Hike up there. Huck up that mountain.
yeah. I'm
Okay,
only
good.
67 this year. That's still young.
Oh yeah, you got plenty of time.
I'm not as fast as I once was, but I can, I don't know. I usually bring somewhere between four and six deer off the mountain every year.
Heck yeah, man.
Bone them
That's
out.
awesome.
One place I'm hunting, I'm 6 miles back in.
Okay, I gotta ask you this one last thing. You've been hunting, spending tons of time out in the wilderness for a long time, over a long career. This is probably a really hard question, but like if you could boil it down to like what's the number one thing you learned? It could be about hunting or it could be about life, but from hunting.
Patience. I'm not a patient man. I get taught that over and over and over when I'm hunting. I'll be calling, and I always think like, oh, if I go over there and do this, I could do it better from there, and I don't sit long enough. And I'll get up to get ready to move, and I'll walk into something that was coming to the call. And I think patience is one of the hardest things. Once you initiate that, it's like throwing a pebble into a pond. Your sound wave or your the waves go out and they reflect off the shore and then come back, and you'll never know how that's going to come back to you. And we often don't wait for that to come back. Patience is a hard thing, and I hate them. I have little of those, but when I have time myself and really forced myself to be patient, I'm usually rewarded.
That's good, man. And also applies to life as well.
Exactly.
Which is one of the beautiful things about
I think a
hunting.
lot of times we need to listen a little bit more.
Absolutely. Well, I've enjoyed listening to you a little bit for the last hour or so. And did you get that picture I sent you?
Oh, wow. Holy buckets. That's a beauty.
A nice one, isn't he?
That is gorgeous. That is gorgeous. Holy crap.
Doesn't even look like a blacktail, does he?
Those are the things of life that we should cherish. Those are incredible moments.
Absolutely,
I'll
man.
send you some images when we get done here.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks again, man. Like I said, I really could talk to you a while. Maybe we can sit down and do another one sometime because this was super interesting. But again, where can folks? Okay, sitkablacktail.com.
.org.
Dot org. Okay, and then obviously. Muledeer.org is a good place to go if you want to join the Mule Deer Foundation, which I recommend. I am a member. So, Dr. Bechtel, thank you so much for your time and look forward to talking to you again sometime.
I appreciate it.